Now available on your smart speaker by saying, Play Radio Station Talking Information Center.
For comments and more information, call 781-834-4400 or visit ticnetwork.org.
Thank you for listening.
WVDF Peterborough, WRS Peterborough, WRSIP Pittsfield, WLLA Londonderry, WVAAMPFL, WDJM Framingham.
It is time now to begin the reading of today's Boston Herald. It is Monday, the 5th of June, 2023, and we say hello today to Alicia.
Hello, happy Monday, and here are your stories from today's Boston Herald. Commuter rail network failing riders group says electrification, lower fares, increased reliability among suggested changes by Matthew Metzger. A scathing new report from transportation watchdog Transit Matters finds the state's commuter rail system is in need of full-scale overhaul if Massachusetts hopes to meet self-imposed net zero carbon goals by 2050. The report, titled Turning Vision into Reality, The Moment for Regional Rail is Now, indicates the state is at a transit crossroads, faced with the choice of maintaining an outdated and ailing diesel fleet or investing in the kind of regional transportation that actually works for residents. The MBTA's commuter rail system is failing the people it should serve, the report reads in part. Riders from gateway cities like Haverhill and Fitchburg must pay high fares for trains that come hourly or worse. Environmental justice communities like Dorchester and Chelsea are exposed to dangerous black carbon emissions from diesel locomotives and are forced to contend with long bus trips because of commuter rail's expense, low frequency, and unreliability. White-collar workers with flexible schedules drive instead thanks to commuter rail's infrequent schedules and poor reliability, adding to the region's traffic congestion while frustrating emissions reduction targets, the report says. According to the report, problems with the commuter rail service come following decades of heavy investment and despite increased government-backed subsidies when compared with the MBTA's rapid transit system. Ridership levels have not returned to pre-pandemic levels, hovering around 30% short of those numbers, speaking to a need to move beyond commuter rail's peak-oriented model to boost ridership and avoid a negative feedback loop imposed by possible service cuts. Transit Matters is proposing the commuter rail, under a regional rail model, should be entirely electrified, its platforms raised and made accessible, stations standardized to improve construction speed, and service increased by up to 300%, which means trains arriving at stations as far as Haverhill every 30 minutes, all day, every day. As the last 3 years have proven, increased remote work has not measurably reduced traffic congestion or vehicle miles traveled. We continue to believe that former Governor Baker's Commission on the Future of Transportation had it right when it declared that Massachusetts needs to move more people in fewer vehicles, they wrote. Electrifying the entire system and putting the corresponding electric trains on the tracks could cost upwards of $8 billion, according to Jared Johnson, executive director of Transit Matters. Still, the cost of not doing so will be higher, according to the report. EMU's trains are roughly 10 times as reliable as diesel locomotives, requiring less maintenance. Their life cycle costs, including acquisition and maintenance, are half the cost of diesels, the report states. Because operating costs are largely driven by the peak, increases in off-peak service incur little additional cost. High all-day frequency would mean the same number of conductors and engineers working the trains could make more trips per shift, reducing the cost per trip. The report also calls for fare adjustments. Under the current model, a rider boarding a train at the furthest commuter rail zone pays as much as $26.80 for a round-trip ride to and from Boston, and that's before paying for parking or a subway transfer, which could push the price closer to $40 for a single day's commute. Under the proposed plan, there would only be 4 commuter rail zones instead of the current 10. And when coupled with a low income discount, a ride from the furthest zone could cost as little as $7.20 round trip. In the short term, a move to cheaper fares represents a commitment to mode shift and transit accessibility for all income levels, a regional and social equity win. In the long term, efficiencies from electrification and higher ridership mean an increase in ticket revenue, the report reads. MBTA will add head of stations job after mishaps by Matthew Metzger. The MBTA's new GM is creating a new head of stations job to oversee operations at the agency's many train stops after a series of mishaps and equipment failures at the facilities. Phil Eng, just a few months into his job as chief of the beleaguered authority, said the need for the role was apparent to him based off of experience at other rail companies. In past agencies, I saw where a head of stations is a single point of accountability, right? Somebody who is managing a team. Obviously, we have many stations across the system, but that team will be there to support this person in terms of the environment of our stations, the safety of our stations, and to bring together all the different functional groups that support addressing those in a more timely manner, he said in remarks Sunday during WCVB's On the Record. Eng's declaration he would find someone to take the reins at the T's several stations comes after one woman was nearly struck by a falling ceiling tile while leaving an MBTA property, and another injured when a utility box used to detect airborne hazards fell from its suspension moorings onto her. The woman struck by the utility box said last month she would file a lawsuit against the T. Eng, the former president of the Metropolitan Transportation Authority's Long Island Railroad, said he takes the condition of stations in the system he's managing personally, and he wants customers to have a point of contact at the agency to air their concerns with. I look at stations, and I've said this in my past roles, it's almost like my living room, right? If I'm inviting someone into my living room, I want them to feel comfortable. I want them to feel safe, and it has to be a welcoming environment, particularly if we want riders to come back, he said. According to Eng, the head of stations would report to him and be responsible for the upkeep of all MBTA stations. It's no small task, he acknowledged, but one that needs to be done right and soon. There's no reason we can't take care of some of these more immediate needs in terms of corrective repairs, cleanliness, and giving that, again, inviting experience, he said. Chuck Todd stepping down from Meet the Press.
Okay, good morning, everybody. It's Monday, June 5th, of course, 2023, and I'm reading from the Lowell Sun, and I'm going to go with a front-page story here with under the heading, Kids Need This, and a Draycott woman is honored for work fighting youth hunger, and there's a picture of her holding a cake. When she's not working in medical bills for Leahy Hospital and Medical Center, Andrea Connolly is packing food into backpacks to gift to kids who need them. As coordinator of Draycott's End 68 Hours of Hunger chapter, Connolly is concerned about the time between Friday lunch and Monday breakfast when students can't rely on meals provided through their schools. In collaboration with school administrators, Connolly finds the kids at risk, and she now supports more than 40 families in every Draycott Public School and at Innovation Academy Charter School in Tamesborough every week. For Connie's dedication to eradicating local food insecurity, she was surprised after the chapter's annual charity motorcycle ride at the boat in Draycott, with two recognitions from the state and Draycott's Board of Selectmen. State Rep. Colin Guy presented the commendation from the Massachusetts House of Representatives, congratulating Connolly for her, quote, extraordinary commitment. Andrea is one of those kids who grew up in Draycott and cares about Draycott kids, Guy said. And that's what she's been doing for the last 10 years, is caring about Draycott kids and making sure they have food on the weekends. It's my pleasure to know her, to call her a friend. When Connolly's grandson moved away, she said she was inspired to pursue a new passion that made a local impact, and families often express their gratitude for her assistance by donating themselves, Connolly said. Claire Bloom, founder and executive director of End 68 Hours of Hunger, thanked Connolly for her tireless efforts in ensuring no child goes hungry. Andrea has been a godsend to End 60 Hours of Hunger, Bloom said. Unfortunately, we have a good number of Andreas because right now we're feeding 8,000 children every single weekend. Money raised from the motorcycle ride and subsequent raffles and fundraising activities will go to the pantry. The event featured a number of local bands and a boisterous crowd of supporters, including the Widow's Sons Riding Association, who are longtime partners and supported the End 68 mission. Connolly spends an inordinate amount of time fundraising for the kids, her sister-in-law Donna Briel said, and has rallied town businesses around her cause. Her good deeds also extend beyond food donations. When a family is recovering from a house fire or personal tragedy, she rounds the troops to gather clothing and supplies. You won't find anyone with a bigger heart, Briel said of Connolly. It is a need, she will do her best to fill it. After about 10 years ago, Connolly started the chapter out of her husband's best friend's basement and has since grown into a space at St. Mary Magdalene Church and boasts a big team of volunteers. During the pandemic, when kids were stuck at home, the district continued to provide lunches the families would need to pick up, but not everyone could drive there, Connolly said. So she filled a flatbed shopping cart full of additional food items from BJ's and traveled door-to-door delivering boxes and bags of groceries. Her volunteer efforts captured the attention of state officials, who alerted her to multiple families who needed help. Connolly's response, what's the address? I wanted to make sure that they knew somebody was there, Connolly said, that we could help take care of them. Connolly's husband, Richard, compared her to the Energizer Bunny, only she would run his batteries out. Years ago, Andrea went into hospital for back surgery, and every single one of the women that worked with her told her that if she did anything with N68 while she was recuperating, they'd quit, Richard Connolly said. They thought that would keep her quiet. From a hospital bed, she was doing fundraising. The current school year found more families without the financial means to reliably feed their children, Andrea Connolly said, making her volunteerism all the more important. This year we saw a drastic increase in the number of children that we feed, Connolly said. Generally, in September, October, the numbers start trickling in from the school. We might start off with 6 to 10 kids, and this year we started off surprisingly, I think, with 41 right off the bat. Seems a lot, but in comparison to some of the other programs, it's a drop. A decade into her community service, Connolly said she is still baffled by the need in the community and dreads the day she can no longer provide for them. It just blows my mind that kids need this, Connolly said. It's a scary thought to think that you're one food stamp away from not being able to feed your kids. Obviously a very dedicated person, Andrea Connolly is. Also from the front page of the Lowell Sun is under the heading Filling a Need, and it refers to service animals. NEADS, AIDS Community with Dogs Ready to Serve. This is from Sarah Arnold. Some dogs just like to work, and NEADS offers breeding, raising, training, and placing service dogs. Their canine campus is in Princeton, and their breeding center is in Sterling. NEADS relies on volunteers from towns in north central Massachusetts, including Leominster, Fitchburg, Lunenburg, Ashburnham, Westminster, Groton, Lancaster, and Shirley, to be volunteer puppy raisers or to work in the canine center and breeding center. Particularly, they are in desperate need of more local puppy raisers. The service dog programs are open to anyone living in central Massachusetts or across the country. Service dogs can be provided to children and adults with hearing loss or a physical disability, children with autism or other developmental disabilities, and veterans with post-traumatic stress disorder. And they also provide assistance dogs who work with professionals in the classroom, in the ministry, therapeutic, hospital, courthouse, and first responder settings. Jed Carter is a veteran from Shirley who is matched with service dog Rafi in March 2021. If I drop something, he is usually picking up before I even give the command. And that task helps so much with my back pain, he says. Having Rafi in my life is a high point. It's like having a permanent battle buddy. NEADS trains Labrador Retrievers and their natural followers through the use of positive reinforcement and clear leadership. The behaviors are taught inherently fun for them, so the dogs learn to associate work like tugging on a rope or running to a sound with having a good time. Food is initially the primary reward in early training. Eventually, being replaced with other incentives such as being petted or a chance to play ball. Each positive experience influences their future behaviors, which ensures a happy working relationship. It costs NEADS approximately $45,000 to breed, raise, train, and match a service dog to mitigate one person's permanent disability. Each NEADS client commits to support NEADS by raising a minimum of $8,000 for the organization, not in order to get a service dog, which you'll get regardless if they're eligible. We believe it's important for our clients to have a vested interest in the organization, and it is this philosophy that allows us to continue to provide our unique and highly trained service dogs to the people. Needs is in Massachusetts, I believe, the original service dog program. And in 1976, Holliston Junior College students tested and confirmed that dogs can be trained to become, quote, ears for people who are deaf or with hearing loss. And with some money from the Medford Lions Club, the first hearing ear assistance dog program began. And then they added people with disabilities in 1986, when they discovered other ways pups could help people, and they moved to West Boylston. Individuals and businesses who don't have time to volunteer can support NEADS through one-time or monthly financial donations, legacy giving, and contributing items on their wish list for the Canine Center and Breeding Center. Local area organizations often hold fundraising events, which is an integral part of the NEADS being able to afford their work. Supporters can also participate in fundraising efforts like Name a Puppy, the Retail Shop, and Needs Day with the Woo Sox at Polar Park in Worcester on June 10th. For For more information on volunteering, donating, or obtaining a service dog, go to naps.org and over to visit.
Thank you, Paul. Debt exclusion vote scheduled for Tuesday in Hayville. This is from the Today's Eagle Tribune by Michael Abella, Hayville. Voters go to the polls Tuesday for a special election to decide how to fund a new $160 million Constantino Middle School. They could approve a debt exclusion or a rollover expiring Hale Hospital debt while using a small amount of the city's excess levy capacity. If the debt exclusion is approved, the owner of the averaged value single-family home in Hayville will pay between $300 and $400 a year in taxes every year for 25 to 30 years' life of the loan for the new school, according to the city's finance department. This does not include any annual tax increase, which for the next fiscal year is estimated to be between $200 and $250 for the owner of the average valued single-family home. If the debt exclusion fails, the city would fund a new Constantino school with a tax of about $66 a year each year for 25 to 30 years life of the loan for a new Constantino for the owner of the average valued single-family home plus expiring Hale Hospital debt. A debt exclusion would be far more costly to taxpayers than funding a new school, as the mayor has proposed. Mayor James Fiorentini said that many people don't understand that what tax impact a debt exclusion will have if approved, and talk about three possible future debt exclusions for other new schools and for a new fire station has people scared. The public expects us to live within our means and only go for debt exclusion or tax override when absolutely have to, he said. We need to reassure the public that we live within our means as long as our mayor, and that's what I've always done. Under an original plan put forward by the mayor to fund a new Constantino without the need for a debt exclusion, the loan would be funded by rolling over payments being made on expiring Hale Hospital debt, meaning the payments being made on that debt would continue to be paid, and also by using a small portion of the city's excess levy capacity. A no vote means the school would be funded by using the money we no longer use to pay the Hale debt, and using some, about $1.5 million a year, of our excess levy capacity to pay the difference, he said. In explaining what excess levy capacity means, the mayor said that for several years the city did not tax to the max. The money we did not tax is called excess levy capacity, and we are allowed to use that now. If there is no vote, we will use the money we are saving by not paying the Hale debt and some of the excess levy capacity to pay for the school. The Yes for Constantino grassroots group that includes city officials, teachers, parents, and other members of the community has been pushing for a debt exclusion, and as part of their campaign, sent out mailers and promoted their campaign on social media. According to a finance filing with the city clerk's office, the Yes for Constantino campaign also called for Hayville for Constantino campaign raised $22,170 as of May 26 and spent $15,185. Donors include Brian Dempsey, who donated $6,000 from his former campaign committee and personally. State Representative Andy Vargas committee $2,000, City Councilor and mayoral candidate Melinda Barrett, $600, Hayville teacher Joanna Dix, $200, School Committee candidate Thomas Branaman, $800, and there's a continuing list of people that donated to this Hayville for Constantino committee. I'm not going to keep reading all the list of names. Back to you, Paul.
Okay, so this is just a couple of stories here. One very brief one, which I tend to read most a week because she's always a very good writer, is Joanne Stelianos, who writes from Nashua. But in the local news, there's very colorful pictures which reflect this time of year, which is graduation ceremonies. And there's very colorful pictures from Tinsborough High's class of 2023 and Draycott High's class of 2023, with pictures of the traditional ceremonial tossing of the mortarboard hats in the air during these graduation ceremonies. This is happens every year now, doesn't it? But in terms of the Whitman grammar story under the heading "Don't Let Summer Pests Ruin Your Fun," I don't know about you, but I've had it, and I'm well near gone. I'll be celebrating. See you later. Good riddance, says Joan. They have followed me into the garden while mowing the lawn, watering the window box, geraniums, trimming the rosewood bushes, talking to my neighbors, opening the trunk of my car, walking around, etc., etc. They just won't get lost. Black flies are those tiny blood-sucking insects that start annoying people around Mother's Day, May 14th, until about Father's Day, mid-June, around here. They've been feasting on my arms, ankles, shoulders, and hopefully nowhere else, she says. I'm a marked woman these days, and those itchy red wells can take forever to disappear. I never feel the gnats or no-see-ums biting me, but a few hours later, little red dots appear and they can swell into penny-sized spots and become very itchy. No, not painful like a bee sting, just uncomfortable and unattractive to look at. It's a losing battle, according to the bug professionals of the entomology extension at Purdue University. There is little that an affected homeowner or person engaging in outdoor activities can do to control black flies. The FarmersAlmanac.com has advice such as being covered in long sleeves and pants at all times outdoors, and apparently you should wear light-colored clothing because these flying nuisances won't bother you as they prefer dark-colored fabrics. And she says, really? Next, you should invest in a dorky-looking netted hat to protect your face and neck, and you can apply natural repellent to any exposed skin. Some of these would include lavender essence oil, extract from pine branches, etc. And I tried spraying peppermint essential oil, as I had read somewhere, and ended up with three welts later. Avoid wearing fragrance and hairspray. Oops, still is charged. A commercial insect repellent containing DEET recommended, but there are experts who claim DEET actually attracts the flies. For relief, wash the affected area with soap and water, try not to itch, and apply a topical solution such as aloe vera, calamine lotion, or even Vicks Vapor Rub. You should also ice the bite as soon as you see it. Look at it this way. Black fly season is a brief one and should be behind us soon. These tiny insects are ruining the ecosystem, providing food for birds, bats, fish, amphibians, and others. You can stay indoors and have a Netflix night for the next 2 weeks remaining, or dare to venture out and enjoy the beautiful June weather and check out what Nashua's air is serving up to residents and visitors. On Wednesday, June 7th, that's this week, Great American Downtown will host the 27th annual Taste of Downtown Nashua at 6 p.m. Buy a ticket and bring your appetite and excitement as more than 30 restaurants and shops pair up this favorite flavorful event. Also, the Nashua Silver Knights, which is a futures collegiate baseball league of New England, are playing all summer long at historic Holman Stadium. It's always a wonderful family evening to take in. The stadium was recently honored with a plaque and added to New Hampshire's Black Heritage Trail for its role in hosting the first racially integrated baseball team in the United States, the Nashua Dodgers, and that was in 1946. It was also at Holman Stadium that the Hall of Fame catcher Roy Campanella and Cy Young award-winning pitcher Don Newcomb played for the minor league affiliate club of the famous Newcomb Dodgers. Nashua has always been a city of substance. Moments like this one do matter. And over to you, Leslie.
Thanks, Paul. Tougher protection shot sought by Christian Wade Boston. The state's hospitals are pushing for a new state and federal workplace protections and tougher criminal sanctions in response to a pandemic-related uptick in violence against healthcare workers. A proposal being considered by the state legislature would set new criminal charges specifically for violence and intimidation against healthcare workers and require hospitals and the state public health officials to establish new standards for dealing with security risks at medical facilities. Under the legislation, anyone who knowingly and intentionally interferes with the conduct of a healthcare facility could be charged and face up to 90 days in prison and $5,000 fine. The proposed charge of aggravated interference with conduct of a healthcare facility could land offenders in prison for up to 5 years as well as $5,000 in fines. The legislation would also require the State Department of Mental Health to set standards for evaluating and addressing security risks at healthcare facilities and require hospitals to develop a workplace violence prevention plan and file annual reports to the state on worker assaults. It would also allow victims of assault and battery or aggravated interference to take paid leave to address criminal proceedings or pursue legal action. A report released by the Massachusetts Health and Hospital Association in January found that every 38 minutes, a healthcare worker in the state is physically assaulted, verbally abused, or threatened. The report found that 96% of violent incidents at hospitals are carried out by either patients, visitors, or non-hospital employees. Most of the victims are nurses, followed by security personnel and other healthcare workers. Of those incidents, 33% were committed by repeat offenders. Abusive incidents do not do more than harm those who have devoted their careers to saving lives. They affect access to compassionate, timely care for patients in need, the report authors wrote. Reported assaults against healthcare workers leveled out throughout most of 2020 when the COVID-19 pandemic led to a drop in patient and visitor volumes at hospitals, but rose steadily throughout 2021 and 2022, the report authors noted. The issue is not unique to Massachusetts, and there has always been an element of risk associated with healthcare jobs, they wrote. Because of the emotionally charged, fast-paced, and other unpredictable nature of healthcare, members of the workforce have encountered unacceptable incidents of violence and harassment while on the job. The push to toughen penalties for violence against healthcare workers is part of a broader national campaign by the American Hospital Association and other healthcare industry groups that are urging Congress to approve federal protections. The Safety from Violence for Healthcare Employees Act would give healthcare workers the same legal protections against assault and intimidation that flight crews and airport workers have under federal law. The plan calls for new federal criminal charges for assaulting healthcare workers and enhanced penalties for use of a weapon and acts committed during a public health emergency. It includes exemptions for individuals who are mentally incapacitated from illness or substance use. The plan would also authorize $25 million in federal grant funding over 10 years to reduce violence and intimidation in hospitals. The funds could be used for training, law enforcement, coordination, and technology. Violence against healthcare workers is all too common, and it is crucial that we do what we can to ensure that these frontline heroes are able to do their job safely and free them from physical harm, threats, or intimidation. Rena Molina, Executive Vice President of 1199 SEIU, United Healthcare Workers East, said in a statement, "Every worker has the right to a safe workplace." Over to you, Paul.
Okay, so page 2 of the LSM here, under the heading Mass Transit, the commuter rail network failing riders, a group says. And this comes from the BostonHerald.com website. A scathing new report from transportation watchdog Transit Matters finds that the state's commuter rail system is in need of full-scale overhaul if Massachusetts hopes to meet self-imposed net zero carbon goals by 2050. The report titled Turning Vision into Reality, The Moment for Regional Rail is Now, indicates the state is at a transit crossroads. Faced with the choice of maintaining an outdated, ailing diesel fleet or investing in the kind of regional transportation that actually works for residents. The MBTA's commuter rail system is failing the people it should serve, the report reads. In part, riders from gateway cities like Haverhill and Fitchburg must pay high fares for trains that come hourly or worse. Environmental justice communities like Dorchester and Chelsea are exposed to dangerous black carbon emissions from diesel locomotives and are forced to contend with long bus trips because of commuter rail's expense, low frequency, and unreliability. White-collar workers with flexible schedules drive instead of, thanks to commuter rail's infrequent schedules and poor reliability, adding to the region's traffic congestion while frustrating emissions reductions targets, the report says. According to the report, problems with the commuter rail service come following decades of heavy investment and despite increased government-backed subsidies when compared with the MBTA's rapid transit system. Ridership levels have not returned to pre-pandemic levels, hovering around 30% short of those numbers. Speaking to the need to move beyond commuter rail's peak-oriented model to boost ridership and avoid a negative feedback loop imposed by possible service cuts, Transit Matters is proposing the commuter rail under a regional rail model should be entirely electrified, its platforms raised, made accessible, stations standardized to improve construction speed, and service increased by up to 300%, which means trains arriving at stations as far as Haverhill every 30 minutes all day. As the last 3 years have proven, increased remote work has not measurably reduced traffic congestion or vehicle miles. We continue to believe that former Governor Baker's commission on the future of transportation had it right when it declared that Massachusetts needs to move more people in fewer vehicles. Electrifying the entire system and putting the corresponding electric trains on the tracks, here's where it gets tricky, could cost upwards of $8 billion. According to Jared Johnson. Still, the cost of doing so will be higher, according to the report. EMU trains are roughly 10 times as reliable as diesel, requiring less maintenance, and their life cycle costs, including acquisition and maintenance, are half the cost of diesel, the report says. Because operating costs are largely driven by the peak, increases in off-peak service incur little additional cost. High all-day frequency would mean the same number of conductors and engineers working the trains could make more trips per shift, reducing the cost per trip. The report also calls for fare adjustments. Under the current model, a rider boarding the train at the furthest commuter rail zone pays as much as $26.80 for a round trip to and from Boston. And that's before paying for parking or a subway transfer, which can push the price closer to $40 for a single day's commute. Under the proposed plan, there would only be four commuter rail zones instead of the current 10, and when coupled with a low-income discount, a ride from the further zone could cost as little as $7.20. I don't know where they come up with that number. In the short term, a move to cheaper fares represents a commitment to mode shift and transit accessibility for all income levels, a regional and social equity win. In the long term, efficiencies from electrification and higher ridership mean an increase in ticket revenue, the report says. And over to you, Leslie.
Thank you. Forensic psychologist supports Brito's insanity defense. This is by Dustin Luca, Salem, Mass. The forensic psychologist called to testify in Brian Brito's defense has concluded and testified last week that he was suffering significantly enough from the mental illness in 2017 that he can't be held responsible for the crimes he committed. He also said the last mental health facility Brito was admitted to before the crimes took place allowed him to fall through the cracks. That psychologist, Fabian Salah, argued led to the crimes he later committed while in a state the doctor describes as schizophrenia unmedicated. Brito, 28, is on trial in Salem Superior Court on three charges stemming from three violent crime scenes in Lawrence Lynn and North Andover in March of 2017. That includes a murder scene in Lynn, a double shooting with no fatalities in Lawrence, and a sexual assault and armed robbery in North Andover. That all took place within 3 days. He pleaded not guilty by reason of insanity to all the charges. Salah supported the plea with his testimony, which took up the entirety of the day Friday and will resume Monday when jurors return at 9:30 a.m. By the end of the day, cross-examination frequently was put on hold by repeated sidebar requests and debate between the defense and prosecution as Jessica Stranzik, prosecutor for the case, highlighted an extensive list of court documents and testimony that Salah didn't use when reaching his conclusion. Salah said he conducted several interviews with Brito, combining for a total time interviewed of 6.5 hours and read a large number of reports and records tied to the case. He spent another 6 or so hours testifying Friday and the 10th day of the trial with questions heavily focusing on the symptoms of schizophrenia and the process through which Salah reviewed Brito's alleged activity. Schizophrenia is a major mental illness and it unfortunately still carries a lot of stigma, Salah said. There are specific symptoms patients present with when afflicted with those conditions. One would be what we call the delusions, and the delusions are fixed false beliefs. They can be beliefs that are bizarre, where you really say, this just doesn't make any sense. For example, the belief that aliens are invading the world. You have that belief and are convinced that that's indeed the case, and you may take steps to protect yourself. Salah also focused heavily on the concept of hallucination and how those present in schizophrenia cases. He later testified that Brito was suffering and showing signs of suffering from auditory hallucinations when several incidents took place from 2014 on to his arrest in 2017. Several also came as Brito believed he had powers that aren't realistic or that he was communicating with religious leaders or people on TV. Command hallucinations are commonly referenced as moments where Brito thought he heard someone instructing him to act in a specific manner. Questions in court on the crimes Brito's accused of first focused on the fatal shooting of Mohammad Reza Sina Zinaband, a 24-year-old Salem man and delivery driver for Lynn Pizza Shop, and when he was shot twice. One shot hit Zinaband in the head, killing him. It was the second of three crime scenes tied to the case. Did you form an opinion as to whether what Brito thought what he was doing was wrong? Asked John Jack Kuna, Brito's defense attorney. He didn't think that what he did was wrong, Salah said. He had in his mind his psychotic way of thinking that he needed to do it, and there was no other way to carry out what he was told to do. Did schizophrenia cause him to lack significant capacity to conform his behavior to the requirements of the law? Kuna asked. The answer would be affirmative, Salah said. Command hallucinations were also a factor in the double shooting in Lawrence on May 25th, Salah testified. In the case of an armed robbery and sexual assault at North Andover convenience store, Salah couldn't determine whether Brito knew his conduct was against the law, given several indicators that Brito understood to some extent that he needed to protect himself. He entered the store holding a gun, so that's one. Then he talked about that he was wearing a mask, Salah said. He asked his victim whether there were anyone in the store, and then asked the victim and asked her to turn off the lights and made her lock the door. These points are important, and then he also added that by telling her not to call anyone and threatening that he'd kill her if she didn't cooperate. While he might have been aware of the wrongfulness of his actions in that instance, Salah said, he was still showing signs of schizophrenia. Years of behavior prior to the three crimes in 2017 made it clear that Brito wasn't properly managing his diagnosis. For example, when hospitalized, he repeatedly denied he was ill, and Salah further testified that he had help by the way of neglect from his last mental health facility he was at before the crimes took place. The testimony at that point focused heavily on a history of troubled behavior Brito was exhibiting over the span of 3 years. That included capturing and burning alive a mouse as a warning to other mice, attacking a postal employee's truck on the described delusional belief that the checks made out to him by President Barack Obama were being stolen from the mail, and more. After much more than a dozen days of repeated schizophrenia diagnosis and treatment in September 2016, following the mail truck incident, Brito was discharged from Bournewood Hospital with a different diagnosis that hadn't appeared in the paperwork up until that point, testimony indicated. Bipolar with psychosis, undifferentiated type. Testimony further indicated Brito didn't take his medication after release, in part shown through a sharp loss of 40 pounds presumed to be tied to medication-related weight gain, Salah testified. This is really a tragedy, in my opinion, Salah said. There were warnings written all over the records that people had, but there was no action and inadequate action to follow up on the warning signs, and this is one of them. If you have somebody who's killing a mouse, burning a mouse, and then saying it was a warning to others and present with behavior as he did in Bournewood, well documented, and this person is released back to the street. Salah said, pausing his thought to begin another, it's really very upsetting to see that because of the tragedy, in my opinion, as I stated in my report, could have been prevented if he was handled properly. The crimes for which Brito is charged took place close to 6 months after his release to Bournewood. Cross-examination between Salah and Strasnick was fairly charged, triggering repeated objections from Kuna and several sidebars and some back-to-back. Strasnick's questions focused heavily on the material Salah referenced in his report to support his conclusion, highlighting the 33 that he listed, and from that point that many others he didn't. That included 14 sets of minutes of grand jury testimony that she referenced, from which he only included 4 in his report. You just randomly pick some records as your source of information, Strasnick said. No, I'm not saying this, he said. I'm just saying that I didn't spend 15 hours going through the listing of records, as I know the discovery record was available to you as it was to me. The cross was paused several times with objections and requests for sidebar conversations from Kuna. In one debate outside of sidebar, Judge Jeffrey Kopp articulated to Kuna that Strasnick was doing her job to pick apart the sources used in the report. Kopp insisted the conversation happened anyway from sidebar, so it would be heard by Brito, who stayed behind and sat alone during all sidebar sessions. He, Salah, testified that he read the police report. He testified that he didn't read the grand jury minutes, Kopp said in an exchange. How is the Commonwealth supposed to respond to that? Certainly, counsel on both sides can cross-examine a witness about things that they may have not considered. Materials not referenced in Salah's work included security video capturing the incident in North Andover, which Salah said he didn't have an opportunity to review. You'd agree with me that really good information for you to have when you couldn't be there would be video, Strasnick said. Video certainly would have been important, Salah said, answered. Yes. Back to you, Paul.
That's a bit of a bizarre tale.
That's an interesting court case. Wow.
Ooh. There is a brief story here in the Lowell Sun, which is kind of a reflection upon a recent historical change that's taken place in this country where states have pretty much legalized marijuana, which for decades, centuries, was not legal. And the heading is True Leave Exiting the Bay State Pot Biz. And you spell that T-R-U-L-I-E-V-E. And there's a picture of a shop with the name True Leave written in big letters, and then beside it, Cannabis Dispensary. After the recreational marijuana market exploded in recent years across the Bay State, more pot shops will soon be shutting down around the region. True Leave Cannabis Corporation recently announced that the marijuana giant will be winding down its operations in Massachusetts. The company's dispensaries in Worcester, Framingham, and Northampton will close at the end of June. This month, and True Leave expects that it will cease all operations in the state by the end of the year. The cannabis behemoth made headlines last year when a worker who was packaging ground cannabis into pre-rolls at True Leave's cannabis processing facility in Holyoke, Massachusetts, suffered an asthma attack and later died in the hospital. The Occupational Safety and Health Administration investigated, and the company later settled with OSHA, which oversees workplace safety. True Leave isn't the first cannabis company to shut down pot shops in the state. Late last year, The Source became the first dispensary to close in Massachusetts. The store was located close to other pot shops in Northampton, Mass. Now True Leave will be taking another marijuana dispensary off the market in Northampton, along with the stores in Worcester and Framingham. The company said it's looking to, quote, preserve cash and improve financial performance. These difficult but necessary measures are part of ongoing efforts to bolster business resilience and our commitment to cash preservation as we continue to focus on our business strategy of going deep into our core markets and jettisoning non-contributive assets. This comes from CEO Kim Rivers in a statement. She says, "We remain fully confident in our strategic position and the long-term prospects for the industry." In December, True Leave had announced a settlement with OSHA that would lead to more health and safety protections for workers at its cannabis manufacturing facilities following the death of the employee. As part of the agreement, the original $35,219 fine against True Leave was reduced to $502. Under the agreement, TrueWeed would study whether ground cannabis dust is required to be classified as, quote, hazardous chemical in the occupational setting according to OSHA regulations. Increased large scale manufacturing in our industry is a relatively new endeavor, and we are determined to continually ask questions and seek answers to make our workplace the safest and healthiest it can possibly be, River said. We already have many protections in place, and we intend to continue our work with state and federal regulators to make sure workers are treated well. Interesting.
Okay, good morning. This is not Elizabeth. This is David. Sorry for being in late. Okay. I'm going to continue to read from the Eagle Tribune that Elizabeth was reading. And I'm on page 2, and it says, tips for helping to prevent dementia. Is there any way you can prevent dementia?
Probably some drug we're working on, I don't know.
I mean, really? Okay, so it goes like this. Someone writes a question and says, I read the other day that every 3 seconds someone develops dementia, okay? And nearly 50 million people in the world are living with the disease. I don't know how they calculate 50 million people, okay? As I get older, I worry about developing Alzheimer's disease. What can I do to keep my brain healthy? Okay. This is a major public health issue for many reasons, not the least of which is because everybody has a brain. Do we think everyone has a brain?
I wonder.
June is the National Alzheimer's and Brain Awareness Month. Okay. Age is the greatest risk factor for Alzheimer's disease, but not the only one. While some changes to our brain and how it functions are inevitable as we age, there is research to suggest adopting healthy lifestyle behaviors may help our brain. Okay, the Alzheimer's Association states the more people know about Alzheimer's, the more action we inspire. It offers these 5 tips. Okay, here come the 5 tips. To promote better brain health, okay. Exercise regularly. Are we okay with that one? Cardiovascular exercise helps increase the blood flow to the body and the brain, and there's compelling evidence that regular physical activity is linked to a better memory and thinking. Okay. Then the next one, it says maintain a heart healthy diet. And I was thinking of going to McDonald's for lunch. Stick to meals full of fruits and vegetables to ensure a well-balanced diet. Some evidence suggests a healthful diet is linked to cognitive performance. The Mediterranean and dietary approaches to stop hypertension diets, which emphasizes whole grains, green leafy vegetables, fish, and berries. That's what you have to eat, twigs and berries, are linked to better cognitive functioning. Get proper sleep. I don't sleep that well. A regular, uninterrupted sleep pattern benefits physical and physiological health and helps clear waste from the brain. Adults should get at least 7 hours of sleep each night and try to keep a routine of bedtime. Okay, another thing is stay socially and mentally active. Meaningful social engagement may support cognitive health, so stay connected with friends and family. Engage your mind by doing activities that stump you, like completing a jigsaw puzzle or playing strategy games, or challenge yourself by learning a new language. At our age, I'm not sure we can learn a new language, and it says, or a musical instrument. Okay, and then it says, keep your heart healthy. Recent research shows strong evidence that a healthier heart is connected to a healthier brain. Aggressively treating high blood pressure in older adults can help reduce the development of mild cognitive impairment. Okay. These tips, as I see Paul's blood pressure rising, these tips are great advice for people of all ages, but especially older adults. Research suggests incorporating all these behaviors will have the greatest benefit, but even one or two can be beneficial. And what about those who take care of the people with the disease? There's help for them too. We offer Building Better Caregivers program through our Healthy Living Center for Excellence. Building Better Caregivers is a workshop offered once a week for 6 consecutive weeks. Is it open to all caregivers? The goal is to learn tools to become better caregivers and help better support your care partner. Well, I can't imagine 6 sessions of that in just patience, right?
It's all good. My doctor's been telling me this stuff for years.
Yeah, but you know what? We can't stop aging.
No, we can't. And I don't know. It is good, I think, to exercise your mind because I think it keeps you alert and keeps you thinking, you know?
Yeah. Well, okay. So now that we've done the first hour, even though I only did 5 minutes of reading, less than that, we're at the mid-show break, and we want you to know that you're listening to the Loyal Association for the Blind's LAB Radio, and the LAB Radio is a member of the Massachusetts Audio Information Network, and the LAB Radio would like to thank UMass Lowell's WUML-FM for providing the radio signal that allows us to broadcast 5 days a week. Paul and I are going to take a 15-minute break, even though I was only here for 5 minutes, and we'll be back at 11:15 to resume our broadcasting, and I will right now switch you back to Marshfield Broadcasting. So we'll be back at 11:15. Bye-bye for now.
Hello, everyone. This is Irene at the Talking Information Center. Today is Monday, June 5th of 2023. I will be reading the Washington Post. NATO-trained units will serve as tip of spear in Ukraine's counteroffensive by Isabel Kushudian and Kamila Harubchik. When Ukraine's long-awaited counteroffensive finally begins, the fight will be led by brigades armed not only with Western weapons, but also weapons know-how gleaned from months of training aimed at transforming Ukraine's military into a modern force skilled in NATO's most advanced warfare tactics. As other Ukrainian units were fighting to expel the Russian occupiers from the countries east and south, the brand new 47th Separate Mechanized Brigade was preparing for the next phase of war from a classroom at a NATO base in Germany. The brigade's leadership trained with computers that simulated situations they might face in real life. Under Major Ivan Shalamaha and others planned their results and then let the program show them the results, how their Russian enemies might respond, where they could make a breakthrough, and where they would suffer losses. You understand the overall picture, how it works, Shalamaha said. You understand where and what your shortcomings were, and we pay attention to what we failed to do during this.
The Eastern needs to be on. That needs to be on.
Units have been armed with Western weapons, including Bradley infantry fighting vehicles, and relocated to a secret location closer to the front line. During a recent visit by Washington Post journalists, the soldiers were waiting for the order to change, to charge ahead to retake a large swath of Ukrainian territory and tip the war back in Kyiv's favor. The counteroffensive will be the biggest test yet of the U.S.-led strategy of giving the Ukrainians weapons and training to fight like an American army might, but on their own.
Ukrainian Defense Minister Oleksiy Reznikov called it the next level of security assistance, something he and other officials requested from their Washington partners. The United Kingdom has been providing basic training to thousands of Ukrainian recruits since last summer. But more recently, whole Ukrainian units have been sent to Germany and other countries to learn how to operate simultaneously together, like interoperability among the different units, Reznikov said. We need company-level, platoon-level, battalion-level training courses with techniques, with their infantry fighting vehicles, with a commander who will understand how to conduct his forces, support artillery, support reconnaissance operations, Reznikov said. Critics of the West's new emphasis on training the Ukrainians in combined arms warfare, in which tanks, artillery, combat vehicles, and other weapons are layered to maximize the violence they inflict, have pointed out that Kyiv is still missing key elements to fully implement that attack, mainly modern fighter jets. Ukraine is expected to receive U.S.-made F-16s after Washington agreed not to stop allied nations from providing them. But they won't reach the battlefield in time for the counteroffensive. One goal of the training is to teach Ukraine's soldiers how to go on offense. For years, the Ukrainian military focused mainly on defensive tactics, how to protect its territory from attack. Even soldiers who fought Russian proxies in eastern Ukraine for 8 years before Moscow's full-scale invasion had little experience with planned assaults. The quick, sweeping counteroffensive last fall to liberate nearly all of Ukraine's northeast Kharkiv region in less than a week was the military's first planned large-scale offensive in the country's more than 30 years of independence. The success in Kharkiv and last year's success defense of Kyiv were credited in part to previous NATO training for Ukraine's military, which began after Russia invaded Crimea and fomented war in the eastern Donbas region in 2014. Many Ukrainian commanders now in senior leadership took part in such training. At the training in Germany earlier this year, the main tasks there were offensive. Only going on the offensive, said a 29-year-old company commander whom the Washington Post is identifying only by his call sign, Tovarish, out of security concerns. We were in constant contact with their sergeants, officers, soldiers, as they trained us, Tovarish said. We had translators with us so we could ask any questions. There was never a time when we asked a question and they didn't respond. Everything was really at a high level. We saw this other level and we need to get there. Shalamaha said the first tasks working with Kora, K-O-R-A, a war game simulator designed for NATO forces, were to plan make-believe operations on foreign soil against a pretend army enemy. The instruction progressed to focus on what lies ahead for Ukraine's military this summer. By the end, Shalamaha was working alongside commanders of other brigades expected to fight in the counteroffensive, coordinating their actions to test how they'd work together on the battlefield. Others in the 47th Brigade received training specific to the weapons or vehicles they'd be receiving, first learning the basics of how to operate them, then how to incorporate them as a single battle unit and then alongside other units. The 32-year-old private
whose call sign is Luke, said he remained in touch with some of the American instructors he met. Sometimes he asks for advice to review some of the things that they taught him. In Germany, they really gave us a good chance to feel how it is going to be, Luke said. As a team leader, I can command like 5 to 7 people, but when it gets to be more than that, you really do need more practice. And then you're trying to organize a whole battalion to move at the same time, and everybody has to know what they're doing. It's really, really difficult. The 47th Brigade started as a battalion that Shalom Maha and Valeri Marcus, a famous veteran and author with more than 450,000 Instagram followers, were charged with creating. It eventually grew to a full-fledged brigade intended to break through enemy lines. I realized that there was indeed an opportunity to create something, something interesting, something important, which could then grow into something much bigger, Marcus said. When I joined the Army 12 years ago, I encountered a lot of things that disappointed me very much. That made me hate the Army, he added. When I received this offer, I saw it as an opportunity to build a unit in which I would have liked to serve 12 years ago. Though still unproven in the battlefield, the 47th Brigade is armed almost entirely with Western weapons, and in a first, nearly every one of the unit's soldiers has undergone a weeks-long course with foreign instructors. The 47th's leadership is also especially young, all born after the fall of the Soviet Union. Alongside Shalom Maha, who is 25, Lieutenant Colonel Alexander Sack, the brigade's top commander, is 28. Marcus, the chief master sergeant, is 29. We are the young generation, Shalom Maha said. We still have our whole lives ahead of us, and we are now fighting for this state, which we want to see for ourselves, for our children, grandchildren, and so on. But the biggest change, they didn't accept anyone interviewing every soldier who wanted to join the brigade. Commanders questioned each person's motivation and readiness. Every candidate had to pass a physical fitness test. Aliona, a 27-year-old teacher who goes by the call sign Airy, was so angry after the atrocities committed last year by Russian soldiers in Bucha, her hometown, that she applied to join multiple assault brigades. Each time she was turned away because she's a woman, told to go back home and cook borscht, she said. Then, earlier this year, Aliona reached out to a commander in the 47th Brigade. He asked her if her mother knew she wanted to fight. She lied and said yes. I told him why I'm here, that it's not to take some photos to post on Instagram, she said. This isn't a joke. As she and others in the brigade wait for the order to begin attacking Russian positions, they're trying to keep their training fresh. Sometimes a commander will scream that someone in their unit is injured, a drill for the soldiers to practice quickly grabbing their tourniquet and applying it to one of their comrades. Most of their activity is saved for nighttime when they practice with night vision equipment. The cover of night helps ensure that any movements won't be spotted by Russian forces awaiting the counteroffensive. We are ready, Shalom Maha said. We have the motivation of people, we have the equipment, and the most valuable thing we have is the spirit to win. He's leading Mexico's probe of the dirty war. Who's Spying on Him? By Oscar Lopez and Mary Beth Sheridan. Mexico City, President Andrés Manuel López Obrador took office vowing to investigate Mexico's worst human rights scandals. And none was graver than the dirty war waged by security forces from the 1960s to the 1980s, in which hundreds of suspected leftist guerrillas were tortured and disappeared, some toffed off planes into the Pacific Ocean. Yet nearly 2 years after the president established a truth commission to pry open the secrets of that dark chapter, signs have emerged that the government's lead investigator has been targeted with military-grade spyware, according to a report obtained by the Washington Post. Pegasus spyware was detected on the phone of Camilo Vicente Ovalle, according to the forensic analysis by Citizen Lab, a digital research center at the University of Toronto. Vicente Ovalle, who coordinates the work of the Truth Commission, had received an email in December from Apple warning he might have been targeted by state-sponsored attackers. The alleged hack is part of a mounting trove of evidence that civilians looking into human rights abuses by Mexico's armed forces, including activists, journalists, even officials close to the president, are being targeted with malware. The Citizen Lab report did not address the question of who might have used Pegasus to hack Vicente Ovalle's phone. The NSO group, which developed the spyware, says it is licensed only to government agencies. NSO questioned the Citizen Lab findings. Investigation by digital rights groups and media organizations have pointed to the Mexican Army as the institution behind the alleged hacks. They have cited the timing and targets, as well as documents on its acquisition of surveillance software in 2019. The New York Times in April reported that the Army was the sole agency in Mexico still operating Pegasus, citing sources familiar with the contracts. Under López Obrador's predecessor, President Enrique Peña Nieto, the Mexican government aggressively used Pegasus to secretly track drug traffickers as well as journalists, activists, and opposition politicians, according to the investigations by Citizen Lab, digital rights groups, and journalists. But when López Obrador took office in 2018, he promised to end the illicit spying on Mexicans not suspected of crimes. He raised hopes that the country would finally unravel what happened during the dirty war and another notorious case, the 2014 disappearance of 43 young men studying at the Ayotzinapa Teachers College. Now, the reports of surveillance are casting hopes for a real reckoning into doubt. This is incredibly troubling, said Jose Miguel Vivanco, the longtime Latin America director for Human Rights Watch, who now works for Denton's Global Advisors. He said the latest revelation, along with recent reports that López Obrador's top human rights official had been hacked with Pegasus, had created a defining moment for the president. This is probably the most serious evidence that the military today is not even under AMLO's or AMLO's control, he said, referring to the president by his initials. Vicente Ovalle and Citizen Lab declined to comment. Neither Mexico's defense ministry nor López Obrador's spokesman responded to requests for comment. López Obrador has denied that the military surveils journalists or human rights defenders. Last month, after the New York Times reported that the discovery of Pegasus on the phone of Alejandro Encinas, the Undersecretary for Human Rights in the Government Ministry, and a longtime ally of López Obrador, the President reiterated, "We don't spy." The President's refusal to condemn the attacks suggested he was caught between his pledges on human rights and his increasing reliance on the military. Not only does López Obrador rely on the armed forces to fight drug cartels, he's also expanded their responsibilities to include overseeing seaports, rolling out coronavirus vaccines, and building major public works projects such as new airports. Carlos Perez Ricart, a member of the Truth Commission, said the president is at a crossroads. A democratic state has to have control over its security and intelligence institutions. Everything indicates this is not the case, said Perez Ricart, a political scientist at the Center for Research and Teaching in Economics. The president has to put a stop to this.
Okay, we are back, and I'll start to read, Paul. So I'm on the Eagle Tribune newspaper, and I'm on the opinion page, and the opinion says theocracy. I have to figure out what theocracy is. Theocracy's foot in the door. So we're going to find out what that means.
I think I know what that is.
Okay, so we'll see. It says here, when the U.S. Supreme Court last year ruled, in effect, that a high school football coach who led his team in Christian prayer at the end of games had a First Amendment right to use public school system to promote his religion, critics warned that this was a foot in the door to more dangerous theocratic intrusions on America's secular democracy. So theocracy must have something to do with religion. Okay, I should have known that. That moment might be now. Religiously based state legislation around the country, including in Missouri, is prying the door wide open using the court's ruling as justification. The faithful should be the first to object to this dangerous mixing of church and state. The case of former Washington State High School assistant football coach Joseph Kennedy is one of those debates that can easily be made to sound like critics are overblowing it. So the coach knelt in prayer midfield at the end of the game, so he invited the players to join him. So most of them did. High school football coaches being something akin to deities themselves in the eyes of the players, eager for a field time. What's the harm? The harm, according to at least one atheist student player who complained, is the implicit pressure to participate in a specific denominational prayer on public school property during a school event led by a school employee. The First Amendment is explicit in prohibiting government, which would include a unit of government like a public school, from promoting religion. The Supreme Court in the past has upheld that principle. But the current conservative majority voted 6-3 on the coach's side, declaring it hostile to religion for the district to prohibit his on-field proselytizing. As the Washington Post reports, that ruling is now being cited by state lawmakers in pushing some of the roughly 1,600 pieces of legislation around the country this year, attempting to further erode the wall of separation between the church and state. Well, I'm going to just digress for a moment. I don't have a prayer I don't have a problem with a prayer. And so if someone has a problem with a prayer, can't they just excuse themselves? I don't know. The epicenter, now not surprising, is Texas, where lawmakers have been pursuing measures including a requirement that schools post the Ten Commandments. Do you know your Ten Commandments?
I used to.
Okay. I know my Ten Commandments. In every public school classroom, one is not to steal, love your neighbor. I mean, none of these are really like...
Covet thy neighbor's wife?
Not to, yes, not to. Or his material, whatever. Yeah, but, I don't have a problem with how about being a nice person and, I know that the 10 of them, but okay, so in every public school classroom. Now, it doesn't say if you post it, right? I'm digressing again. It doesn't say that every kid has to come into the room and cite the Ten Commandments before he can sit down. You don't have to look at it, right?
I think it's the... I think you said foot in the door. I think it's the foot in the door theory. Okay. Once it starts, it can lead to more...
Yeah. So, okay, so I'm going back to the reading. So proponents of that and other bills forcing religious dogma upon believers and non-believers alike no longer even bother to deny that's what they're doing. There is absolutely no separation of God and government, one Texas lawmaker declared, in defiance of the plain language of the Constitution. It's not real. Not to be outdone, Missouri lawmakers have sent Governor Mike Parson a bill to allow public school districts to teach elective courses on the Bible. I don't have a problem with elective courses.
Elective.
You don't have to go into it, right?
Yep.
What? I don't see what's wrong with that.
Mm-hmm.
From a historic and literary standpoint, so why is such legislation necessary right now? Given the wider conservative movement towards outright theocracy, it's a question Missouri leaders should answer. Okay, I don't know what this. I don't know what the. I don't know what the Eagle Tribune was aiming at when they wrote this. But I don't know. Well, okay, we don't want to be too controversial on the radio.
Yes.
All right, Paul, I'll send it to you.
Okay, so I'm going to combine two. Shorter stories here, one of which is, this is Monday, June 5th, and there is a section in the Old Sun about what happened today in history, which I think is sometimes interesting, and then I will describe what the Massachusetts weather will be for the week ahead, always something that people are interested in. Let's start with the today in history, and on this date, in 1794, a long time ago, Congress passed the Neutrality Act, which prohibited Americans from taking part in any military action against a country that was at peace with the United States. That's interesting. And then we come to 1950. The U.S. Supreme Court in Henderson versus the United States struck down racially segregated railroad dining cars. In 1967, war erupted in the Middle East, and Israel, anticipating a possible attack by its Arab neighbors, launched a series of airfield strikes that destroyed nearly the entire Egyptian Air Force. Syria, Jordan, and Iraq immediately entered the conflict. 1968, Senator Robert F. Kennedy was shot and mortally wounded after claiming victory in California's Democratic presidential primary at the Ambassador Hotel in Los Angeles. The assassin, Sirhan Bishara Sirhan, was arrested at the scene. 1975, on this day, Egypt reopened the Suez Canal to international shipping, 8 years after it was closed because of the 1967 war with Israel, which we have mentioned. And in 1976, 13 people were killed when the Teton Dam in Idaho burst. On to 1981. The Centers for Disease Control reported that 5 men in Los Angeles had come down with a rare kind of pneumonia, and they were the first recognized cases of what later became known as AIDS. In 2002, 14-year-old Elizabeth Smart was abducted from her Salt Lake City home and Smart was found alive by police in the Salt Lake suburb in March of 2003, which is 1 year later, and one kidnapper, Brian David Mitchell, was sentenced to life without parole, and the other one, Wanda Barzi, she was released in September of 2018. And the last Today in History, Monday, June 5th, in 2004, Ronald Wilson Reagan, the 40th President of the United States, died in Los Angeles at age 93 after a long struggle with Alzheimer's disease. And then, very quickly, getting to the weather for this week, the headline is Cool Week Ahead, Better Next Weekend. After the first weekend of June was cool and raw, far from ideal for a beach trip, will next weekend feel more like summer? National Weather Service meteorologists are seeing encouraging signs that warmer temperatures and drier days will arrive in Massachusetts for the second weekend of June. But ahead of next weekend, the region will have a chance of rain showers each day, including at least one day with a chance for some thunderstorms. Temps should remain cooler than average during the work week until a warm-up towards the weekend. While this weekend is obviously a damper, next weekend should look considerably better. Andrew LeConte, meteorologist at the National Weather Service in Boston, told the Herald. The weather on Sunday felt more like mid-April than the first weekend of June, as temps remained stuck in the 50s along with periods of rain. The work week should start off with a continuation of the weekend with a lot of cloud but fewer showers. It should be breezy in eastern Massachusetts, along with cool temps in the upper 50s to lower 60s. Temps should improve on Tuesday into the 70s, which is closer to normal for the beginning of June. With that, there will be a risk for some showers and thunderstorms later in the afternoon into the evening, LeConte said. It's not looking like it will be severe at this time. Then the cooler weather pattern is expected to return from Wednesday to Friday with below normal temps in the 60s. There will be off and on chances for showers, but nothing looks like a washout, LeConte said. And then finally, a break from the cool and wet weather is possible for Saturday and Sunday with sunny skies and temps around 80 degrees by the end of the weekend. And that's over to you, Taylor.
Okay. Thank you, Paul. Okay, Paul, are you ready for Dear Abby?
I am. I think I'm ready.
All right. So I'm not going to call it Dear Abby. I'm going to call it Dear Paul.
There you go.
Okay, Dear Paul, I have a child with a woman that I call Kara, all right, who is now my... Wait a minute. I have a child with a woman I call Kara, who is now my ex-wife. Okay, so the ex-wife's name is Kara. Okay. Okay?
Yeah.
Our son lives full-time with me and my new wife, so his stepmother, right, whom I married 3 years ago. Kara, his old wife, was diagnosed with schizophrenia 5 or 6 years ago, which is what ultimately led to our divorce. She has only recently been able to keep a job despite her condition, which is only being moderately well-managed, but she has a pretty good one now. Okay. Kara, the ex-wife, spends almost all her money on herself and rarely spends a day with our son without me present. I'm considering asking the court for child support payments, but I worry that because of her mental issues, she'll end up taking it out on our child. She's never been a very good parent, largely because of her illness, and she lives with us for almost a year because I didn't have the heart to see her homeless. I don't make a lot of money myself. I've been disabled for quite some time. Oh. And the extra income would make a big difference in our son's quality of life. Am I wrong to request child support judgment? If Kara loses her job, it could mean jail time, which would be devastating to her. But I don't believe she would comply with any informal request. I could really use some sound advice. Man, this is a tough one.
where do you begin with this one?
So I assume I assume it's a male. And is disabled. The ex-wife has schizophrenia. So I don't know. What do you do? So the guy wants to have his ex-wife, the mother of the child, give child support.
Well, in this kind of situation, I think I would say that he should go ahead and go through the courts and see if he can make a claim for child support and let an independent thinker sort through this messy problem and make a decision whether she pays child support or not.
Okay, now here's the answer that Dear Abby writes back. She says, I agree. You do need advice, and the person you should seek it from is an attorney who specializes in family law. From what you have written, Kara appears to be doing the best she can just to get by as you are. You did not mention whether your new wife is employed. If the answer is no, because finances are strapped right now, would she be willing to find a job or part-time work in order to make things easier for your son? If she could, it might relieve some of your stress. Well, but like you said, Paul, you got to get an independent third person, you know, advice from a professional on how you should proceed. Oh my gosh. So, okay, maybe this one will be easier. Dear Paul, I'm living in my father's home along with my younger sister. Okay? So, I'm living in my father's home along with my younger sister. I'm currently looking for work so I can move out. My plan had been to look for roommates online, but my sister wants us to get a place together. Okay. Everyone else in our life agrees that this would be the best idea. I do not want to do this. I am honestly afraid of my sister. She has a hair trigger temper that she keeps in check for other people, but will fully unleash on me. I try to have fun with her, and sometimes I do, but I inevitably become the target of her anger for reasons I can never predict. I'm afraid to speak to her for more than a few minutes because she twists almost everything I say into an attack on her, even the most lighthearted things. She is also careless with my property and has already damaged some of my things. She triggers my anxiety to the point that I can't think straight. I mostly just hide it from her. Yet she still insists that we should live together and is complaining more and more about how my financial situation is preventing her from moving out as soon as she likes. How on earth do I approach this? No matter what I say to our family, no one can offer advice, and it seems like no one is on my side. It makes me want to cry. I think this is a pretty easy one, Paul. Go ahead.
Well, I think that what you should do is just quietly pack your belongings, find a roommate, find something affordable, and move out without saying anything to your sister or anybody else. Just get out of the house and find someone else to live with. So you can't be accepting that kind of belligerence, I would say.
Well, I 100% agree with you. And the only thing I would add to it is, could you move out at 3 in the morning? Okay, so Dear Abby writes back, your sister appears to have mental problems that none of the rest of the family wants to acknowledge. Under these circumstances, you should absolutely not move in with her. To avoid it, you must grit your teeth, dry your tears, and keep saying no. And leave at 3 in the morning. You know?
Yes.
So,
sneak out of there.
Yeah. Some of these are... That one was pretty easy. I mean, yeah. Why would you even ask for advice? Okay, I got one more short article before I turn it back to you, Paul. It says, U.S. drivers likely to see higher gas prices. Oh, here we go again. Saudi Arabia will reduce how much how much of oil is sent to the global economy, taking a unilateral step to prop up the sagging price of crude after two previous cuts to supply by major producing countries in OPEC. The Saudi cut of 1 million barrels per day to start in July comes as the other OPEC producers agreed in a meeting in Vienna to extend earlier production cuts through next year. Here we go again, the rising prices of gasoline at the pump. Calling the reduction a lollipop, I don't know what that means, calling the reduction a lollipop, Saudi Energy Minister Bin Salam said at a news conference that he wanted to ice the cake. He said that the cut could be extended and that the group will do whatever is necessary to bring stability to the market. When they say stability to the market, you mean increase the prices to the market. There is stability in the market as far as, I guess, there's plenty of gas, but the new cut would likely push up oil prices in the short term, but the impact after that would depend on whether Saudi Arabia decides to extend it. The move provides a price floor because the Saudis can play with the voluntary cut as much as they like. The slump in oil prices has helped U.S. drivers fill their tanks more cheaply and gave consumers worldwide some relief from inflation. Yeah, that's true. Gas is not going to become cheaper. If anything, it will become marginally more expensive. That the Saudis felt another cut was necessary underlines the uncertain outlook for demand for fuel in the months ahead. There are concerns about the economic weakness in the U.S. and Europe. While China's rebound from COVID-19 restrictions was less robust than many had hoped, Saudi Arabia, the dominant producer in the OPEC oil cartel, was one of several members that agreed on a surprise cut of 1.6 million barrels per day in April. The kingdom's share was 500,000. That followed OPEC announcing in October that it would slash 2 million barrels per day, angering U.S. President Joe Biden by threatening higher gasoline prices a month before the midterm elections. All told, OPEC has now dropped production on paper by 4.6 million barrels a day. But some countries can't produce their quotas, so the actual reduction is around 3.5 million barrels per day. The previous cuts gave little lasting boost to oil prices. International benchmark Brent crude climbed as high as $87 per barrel, but has given up its post-cut gains and has been loitering below $75 per barrel. That has helped U.S. drivers kicking off the summer travel season, with prices at the pump averaging $3.55, down $1.02 from a year ago. So were we paying like $4.57 last year?
Yeah, I think so.
I don't remember that much, but wow.
That's national average, I would say.
Falling energy prices also helped inflation in the 20 European countries that use the euro drop to the lowest levels since before Russia invaded Ukraine. The Saudis need sustained high oil revenue to fund ambitious development projects aimed at diversifying the country's economy. Well, you know, they have a lot of leverage. That's why I always feel like we should keep drilling ourselves.
Yeah, we've got to reduce the dependence upon these Arab dictators.
I think they say we got so much oil reserve in Alaska. I don't know. I'm always saying drill, baby, drill, but I'm not the president.
Mm-hmm.
So, okay, Paul, I'll turn it to you.
This comes under the heading of Beacon Hill Roll Call, and it's just an insight into some of the bills which the Massachusetts Senate and House of Representatives are considering these days. And the first one is it's under the heading $300,000 for drink spiking crisis. The Senate, by a 39-0 vote approved an amendment that would provide $300,000 for the state to develop, research, and recommend strategies to address the rising incidence of reported drink spiking in the Bay State. The funds could also be used for a public awareness campaign about drink spiking and the bulk purchase of drink spiking test kits to be distributed at bars, restaurants, and other nightlife establishments across the state. Drink spiking is when a person adds alcohol or other drugs to someone's drink without their knowledge. This can lead to many things, including sexual assault or the intent to hurt or steal from that person. Over the last year alone, the Commonwealth has seen an alarming increase in the number of reported drink spiking incidents at bars, nightclubs, concert venues, and even house parties across the Commonwealth, said the sponsor, Paul Feeney, Democrat from Foxborough. These incidents are all too common, and we've seen countless warnings from law enforcement. Use the buddy system, cover your drink, and don't leave your drink unattended. Yet reports of these incidents persist, and the Commonwealth's response is still catching up to the onslaught of these reports. Who knew? And then another bill is calling for an additional $400,000 for the prevention of hate crimes. The Senate, by once again a 39-0 vote, approved an amendment that would increase funding by $400,000 from $400,000 to $800,000 for grants to schools for the prevention of hate crimes and incidences of bias in public schools. The grants would be used for education, professional development, prevention, or community outreach, prioritizing schools that have experienced hate crimes or incidences of bias within the last 2 years. With skyrocketing incidents of hate crimes and bias against people of color, LGBTQ community, individuals, Jewish people, and other minority groups, these programs are now more important than ever, said Senator Mike Moore, a Democrat from Millbury. Addressing misinformed beliefs during children and teens' formative years is the best strategy for preventing discriminatory behavior down the road. Hate has no home here in Massachusetts. I'm pleased to have received my colleagues' support on this critical funding. Also on Beacon Hill, a couple of more small items, is under a bill called H 369 on the purchase of alcohol. The Consumer Protection and Professional Licensure Committee held a hearing on a bill that would allow liquor and retail store clerks to accept a valid photographic non-duplicate motor vehicle license issued by other states as a valid form of ID to purchase liquor in the Bay State. The Commonwealth invites people from across the country to our sporting and live events, as well as to vacation and tour our historical sites, said Paul McMurtry, the Democrat from Dedham. It only makes sense that we allow our licensees to be able to serve these individuals using their state identification. In addition, this will give our businesses and restaurants additional sales and help them recover from losses during the pandemic. And just one more one more bill is the requirement of Narcan in college dorms and housing. And it would require all state universities that have dormitories or other housing for students to have Narcan or similar opioid antagonists in each college-operated housing building. Narcan is an emergency treatment used for the complete or partial reversal of opioid overdose. The bill would also require that all resident assistants employed in the school be trained in the administration of Narcan. Massachusetts set a new record high for overdose deaths in 2021, with 2,290 lives tragically lost, said the sponsor, John Velas, a Democrat from Westfield. Opioid antagonists like Narcan can continue to be our best tool to reverse overdoses when they occur, and this legislation would help expand access to this critical medication on college campuses throughout our state. And over to you then, David.
Okay, back to the opinion page of the Eagle Tribune. And there's a letter to the editor, and the guy's name is Joe DeMori, and he's a former Pawtucket Regional School District School Committee member. So he's writing a letter that says, leadership failure, fuels assault on homeowners. Again, it's leadership failure fuels assault on homeowners. Recently, in the towns of Groveland and Merrimack, voters very narrowly delivered the required votes to usher in Proposition 2.5 override to assess an additional $1.25 million in personal and property taxes from Groveland taxpayers and $860,000 from personal and property taxes from Merrimack taxpayers. So people okayed to go over 2.5% increase. The goal outlined by the Pawtucket School Committee was to fully fund a $50 million budget requirement for the Pawtucket Regional Schools. What differs this override request from former ones is the ominous because the request was made for initiating operational overrides. This is simply money to pay the bills. What is far more palatable for many taxpayers are strategic initiatives like building new schools and past campaigns, including a more recent effort to build a new high school and middle school were widely supported. May 3rd on WHAV, Superintendent Justin Bartholomew opined, "I think what this does for us is to bring it back a lot of the lost additions that had to be cut last year, and it also reinstates the arts and athletic programs to where they were prior to last year's failed budget." Understandably, by mandate, school committees and those they employ in the form of superintendents prioritize funding over taxpayer concerns when they're opposing interests. Certainly, well-funded, high-performance school systems are historically beneficial for a general long-term appreciation of home values. Okay, that's how we're getting into home values. They also strengthen community ties, and collectively, communities can continue to pay it forward by maximizing opportunities for children to have the best chances for success in life and a well-rounded education. But from a financial standpoint, there's a breaking point for homeowners, especially when exponential increases in property taxes caused by overrides leads to a point where the growth of taxes exceeding the growth of property values creates a negative spiral. I never looked at it that way. If your taxes increase greater than the value of your home, you have a negative spiral there. There is a point when taxes are so high that they will exert an inverse pressure on home appreciation, and Pawtucket towns may face this in the not-too-distant future. Chapter 70 relates to state dollars that contribute portions to municipalities to pay for school costs. Specifically, it's named for the section in the Mass General Law from which it originated. Net school spending is an important concept in school budgets. That concept involves subtracting the cost of transportation, debt service, civic activities, crossing guards, capital equipment. Okay. In fiscal year 10, the Pawtucket Regional Schools received $13 million with an enrollment of 3,000. The percentage of NSS was 44%. I don't know what these... Every single year since that time up to 2022, the percentage steadily declined, resulting in $13 million with an enrollment of 2,200. Though these facts plus several other drivers of budget increases were well documented by school leaders for the last 2 years, very little advocacy was directed to state leaders to address the the shortfalls. In fact, another component known as the foundation budget relative to state aid was $25 million in fiscal 10 and $25 million in fiscal 2022. Once again, the percentage reduction in all years was steadily downward. I don't know what they're talking about here. You know? But I think what they're saying is, and I haven't finished it, is that if your home value every year is increasing, let's say, by 4%, and your taxes are increasing by more than 4%, yes, you've got a kind of an inverse.
Yeah, I think that's what it is. Yeah. So.
Yeah. But something tells, I don't know. Who knows? It's hard to calculate this. The abject failure of leadership at Pawtucket has nothing to do with the operation of the school and addressing the glaring shortfalls by a disconnected Commonwealth of Massachusetts, whose legislators have steadily reduced support by simply flatlining or reducing state aid. As stated, they have a mandate to protect our schools. But one will find very little evidence in public meetings or actions taken by school leaders to bring the problem to the state and take actionable steps to materially reverse the trends. Leadership is tone deaf to the realities that there are two primary sources of school funding. One is taxpayers and the other is the state. Okay, so the state must kick in some. Yep. Instead, they celebrate the passing of an override as a successfully concluded campaign against Pawtucket taxpayers. Clearly, the taxpayers are viewed as the proverbial low-hanging fruit. In other words, they can get it easily from us. Mm-hmm. Apparently, attempting to compel the Commonwealth to bring funding to adequate level is too far-fetched. In complicity with leadership failures are past and present legislative leaders who have not produced any results in moving the needle to address the state funding gaps and therefore also silently burdening local taxpayers. I'll write more about this in my continuing series. This condition will eventually come to a head, and it would be prudent for school leaders throughout the state to stop viewing homeowners as the fattened goose. You look like the golden goose over there, Paul.
Oh, my goodness. Basically, so the only things you can guarantee are gas and taxes.
Oh, gosh. So, Pawtucket school leaders are misguided in thinking that perpetual operational overrides will be funded by compliant citizenry. The district requires strong leadership from its appointed and public officials to strive for academic excellence. Mindful, however, that in the real world, financial constraints on hard-pressed taxpayers must be factored into the equation. Now, Paul, they're coming for your wallet.
Like I said, you know.
Yeah. So, do you have a short one for us?
Yeah, I have a pretty short one here, which was I saw this in news this morning myself about an apartment building which collapsed in Iowa, a really bad looking scene. But anyway, the headlines: missing man's body recovered at the site of a collapsed apartment building. The body of one of three men who had been missing after a partial collapse of an apartment building in Davenport, Iowa, has been found. Brandon Colvin's body was recovered Saturday. Two other men, 51-year-old Ryan Hitchcock and 60-year-old Daniel Prune, are still unaccounted for. Colvin is the first person confirmed to have died in the collapse. The Quad City Times reported that Colvin's son Brandon graduated from high school Saturday, and he and other family members had been at the collapse site almost constantly hoping for a miracle. The discovery of Colvin's body came a day after authorities announced that the search for survivors would be completed, with attention turning to shoring up the structure so recovery efforts could begin. The remains of the six-story apartment building were constantly in motion in the first 20 to 36 hours after it collapsed, which officials said posed a risk to rescuers who were trying to search for survivors. City officials had said earlier that Colvin, Hitchcock, and Preen had a high probability of being home at the time of the collapse. And authorities have said that searching the building is extremely dangerous and it was constantly shifting and at risk of further collapse, putting everyone at risk.
We're doing the best we can to balance the building condition and the safety of our responders, Fire Chief Mike Carlson told reporters during that briefing. He said conditions have forced a response that may take days or weeks. Mike Mattson, the mayor, had said the debris pile could be a place of rest for some of the unaccounted, which would have meant. Work to bring down the building is moving forward amid questions about why neither the owner nor the city officials warned residents about a potential danger, even after a structural engineer's report issued just days before the collapse indicated a wall of the century-old building was at imminent risk of crumbling. Documents released by the city show that city officials and the building's owner were warned for months that parts of the building were unstable. Tenants also complained to the city in issues about a lot of problems, they say, were ignored, including no heat or hot water for weeks, mold, water leakage from ceilings, toilets. And while city officials tried to address some complaints and gave vacate orders to individual apartments, a broader evacuation was never ordered. Current and former residents told the Associated Press about interior cracks on the wall that ultimately collapsed that were reported to the building management. Andrew Ward, the building's owner, released a statement saying, and here we go again, quote, "Our thoughts and prayers are with our tenants."